Last evening in the Station House Theatre in Clifton, a book launch took place. The book, called A Colony of Strangers by Kathleen Villiers Tuttle, was launched by a direct descendant of the founder of Clifton, John Darcy. Adrian Led was his name. We have a recording with him, which you'll hear later, and of course the author herself, Kathleen Villiers Tuttle. So I hope you'll enjoy this recording. Before the crowds arrive, we've grabbed Kathleen for a little while. First of all, Kathleen, congratulations on the launch of your sixth book. It's a beautiful production, and I think as people arrive here this evening and see it, they'll be very happy and hopefully very tempted to buy it.
Thank you very much.
Kathleen, since I think we were last talking to you as well, you received an honorary degree from NUIG for your work on history, as a historian. So also congratulations on that. So that was a very nice honour.
It was wonderful, and it was totally unexpected. And so it was a great treat to actually receive a degree. And it just makes you feel so good that people actually have noted your work and consider it worthy of a degree.
Well, we're here at the launch of your sixth book, so your skills are well honed at this point. I take it that it's no accident that this is being launched on the bicentenary of Clifton.
Well, yes and no. I actually thought I'd have it out last year, but it went on a little bit longer than expected. And I am pleased that I actually have it out before the full ceremony start at the end of May. So that was a bit of an achievement. And for a while there, I thought I'd have it out afterwards, which would be a complete disaster. So at least it's coming out at the right time.
Yeah. A Colony of Strangers is the title. It's intriguing. Where did that title come from?
The title, it came from a man named James Dowd, who actually built what is now known as Hare's Shop in Clifton. And it's a quote from information that he actually gave to a government inquiry, whereby he's asked to describe Clifton and talk about what Clifton was like when he came. And he says that it was a complete colony of strangers. And he arrived in Clifton in 1819. And that's how he described the town. And I just thought when I read it, it was a fantastic title for a book.
And I suppose that brings us back to the founding of Clifton by John Darcy in 1812. So what was here before John Darcy? Who was living in the area? How populated was it, for example?
The land had been in the Connemara estates had been in the Darcy family since the 1640s. So the family had a house here, but I'm not exactly sure where the location of that particular house was. But it was populated by a fair group of people now, and they lived mostly along the coast. And there would have been sort of middlemen, men that who had leased large sections of land from the Darcys. The Darcys' main house was over in Kiltulla in East Galway. And they had leased land from the Darcys, and then they had sublet it to smaller tenants. Some of the land they would have kept for their own use. And they would have built substantial houses. So there were a few substantial houses, sort of the Connisses had them, the Slopers, and you would have different families like that are well known. Some of them sort of would be the Blakes and the Lynches and many of the names that you now associate with the tribes of Galway. But of course, there were extended branches to those families that wouldn't have been as well off as some of the main branches of those families. But there were various people that names still lived on, and some of them still live on today. And then, of course, there would have been the smaller farmers and the small fishermen, and many of their descendants are still with us today too.
So when John Darcy, and I'm really surprised, I just learned from your book, that he was only 19 years of age when he undertook this development of Clifton Town.
Yes, in 1804 he inherited the family estates, and he was just 19 years of age at that time. And within 6 months he married. And his main residence at that time would have been over in East Galway, in Kiltulla, in the family home. But he had a great fondness for sailing, and it was that we learn later attracted him to the west. This would have been the largest section of his land, the largest portion of these estates, but it wouldn't be anything like the wealthiest. The land here would have been poor quality, and the tenants wouldn't have been wealthy. He had better land on the east side of Galway, but he seemed to be more attracted to Connemara from the start. And very early on, he started to make plans for a town.
How do you make plans for a town?
Well, the way I figure he did it, and that's just from the research that I've done, was they have now in the you see, you're always, new material is always turning up, and in the National Archives at the moment they presented me with a whole stack of new material, which was the what they call the presentment books for Galway County. And these would have been a bit like what the county council now would have where you're asking for permission to build a stretch of road or something like that. So these presentment books were where local landlords applied to the grand jury, which were the precursors of the county council, to construct a stretch of road, usually in their own estates, and usually to facilitate themselves to improve the access to their own estates or the quality of the roads within their own estates. So by going through those, I was able to see what roads John Darcy first applied for when he came in. So this was earlier than anything I had uncovered before on the construction of roads in Connemara, and that was about, you know, 1809, just after he had inherited. So you saw that he was literally building new roads, and sometimes he was calling them roads, but in actual fact, they were of a better quality and standard than other applications for other parts of the county. So I could see that he was really building streets and improving the streets in and around this particular area, which the townland was known as Clock Valley before it became known as Clifton. So that's how I knew what he was planning and how he was planning it.
Who did he expect to inhabit these dwellings once he constructed the town, basically?
No, he would have constructed and improved the roads, and then he striped up the land into small portions, and he encouraged people to come in, and you would rent a small section of land, and on that land, a stipulation in your lease was that you would build a house on the land, and they had to be two-storey, and then later on they had to be slated. So he improved the standard. He made greater demands on the tenants as time went on, and the people then tended to open a shop or a workshop or something at the ground level and lived on the one or two stories up above that.
And who did he target particular types of people he wanted? I can't imagine that there were local people who were in a position to take up these leases.
Well, in some cases they were, and in some cases you get the feeling from the names that they were people from his estate. Now, some of them were from his estate in Connemara. They would have been from the outlying area where we'd have encouraged the sons of farmers to come in and try their hand at being business people. And in other cases, they probably came from other estates of his over on the East Coast. But there were certainly people, we know of one family from Limerick, and, you know, there were people from all over, and certainly from some of the names, the fact that they were very Protestant names. Some of them were kind of English names, and they were tradesmen, they were craftsmen, and they came in here to improve their own lot. And they saw an opportunity in a new town, a new market. So this is really what drew them in here. And the main thing was the fact that he was offering leases at low rent, long leases, very, very good leases. And they were renewable leases forever. It meant that once you got this section of land, whatever you built on it, your landlord could not interfere with you. You were literally just paying him a ground rent. You could sell the property on afterwards, and you would get the value of your anything that you had invested in it. Now, that was the sort of thing that Parnell was looking for and Davitt were looking for nearly 70 years afterwards. But John Darcy was granting that here at that time in order to encourage the people in. So it was that kind of standard of lease that he was offering was what really attracted the people to come here.
Are there any names that came in at that time that are still here?
There is one particular family that stands out right away, and that's the Stanleys on the corner. He came in as James Griffin. Their ancestor came in as James Griffin, and he literally purchased that section of land on the corner. He also purchased land up on the square. But he decided, which to me indicated the fact that the lower part of the town was the first to develop and was considered to be the most advantageous position, location to have your business, because he built that shop where Stanley's are now, and he leased out the land that he had up at the square. Now, I deal with that, all of that in the book, but his daughter, or no, it wasn't his daughter, it was further down the line, a Griffin lady married a Stanley man, and that's how they're Stanley's today, but they are one of the original families from the very beginning.
And Catherine, because you mentioned there Church of Ireland and Protestants, do you think from your research, had he a preference, you know, whether his tenants would be Church of Ireland or Roman Catholic, or was it immaterial to him?
I think it was totally immaterial to him, and I think he didn't. His determination from the beginning seemed to be that he would foster the people, and that he would foster a community and develop a community where everybody would be included. He just saw no divisions, and when he was writing to Dublin Castle, he would stress the fact that there was no religious divisions between his tenants, and that all people pulled together. He would state that they came from various parts of the country, of various religions, and that they all worked very well together. His son, of course, Hyacinth, had an entirely different approach, but that's almost another book.
In the book, the reference to the people who inhabited, or that Connemara was kind of, it sounded like a place full of smugglers and rebels.
Yes, prior to John taking over the land, that was the reputation it had. And from the records and the letters that I've uncovered in Dublin Castle, that exactly was what it was like. I mean, smuggling was rampant, and the place, and they're named the men that were left over after the 1798 rebellion, who had come down from Mayo and were in open hiding, if there's such a thing, because they knew they were safe from the military, because there was no military barracks beyond Oughterard, and there was no police presence or anything here in those very early days. So they lived quite openly, and they were in the protection of the local people, and when they knew that the army or the military were coming in, they would take to the mountains and go into hiding, and then they came back down again and lived quite openly, as I say. So that was the reputation, that was the type of people that really were. I used to think that was just, you know, an old slogan that was thrown out, but right up until John Darcy took over the land, that's what it was like. And then I covered an incident in 1810 when there was a certain amount of secret societies in operation here, and you can see that there was that worry that these elements would rise to the fore and cause trouble. So they were still kind of, the remnants were still hanging on even in 1810. So it was just after that then that the presence of government presence in the form of military and police were much stronger afterwards.
And if, I suppose, you know, things like smuggling and that, and I suppose whatever illicit activity could thrive if the area was inaccessible and it wasn't easy for the military to get in, did that mean that when John Darcy started improving roads, was there any kind of discomfort or resentment amongst those people that he was doing this, that he was opening up the area to the authorities?
Yes, there certainly was a lot of resentment. They felt that they never mentioned the fact that they resented the fact that there was the notion that smuggling would be interfered with. But when we think of smuggling, we think of all sorts of claret and brandy and tobacco. And that was true. But the majority of things that were smuggled were simply similar to what goes across the north today, between the boundaries of ourselves and Northern Ireland today. It was anything that there was duty on, that they could avoid paying duty on. So even salt, you know, was smuggled. Just depended on what the biggest duty was on at the particular time, that was a smuggled item. But the most thing they resented, though, those who would have been the middlemen who held sections of land from John Darcy prior to the construction of the roads, they now felt that once the roads were built, that they had competition for the land. So as before that, nobody wanted to be bothered holding land out here. All of a sudden, John Darcy was bringing in competition for land. So they resented the fact that the price probably went up for land, which they had it all to themselves before that.
And again, from your research, what kind of man was John Darcy? I mean, he seemed quite visionary, very, I suppose, for that time, very conscious of, you know, free from discrimination. And so what was he like?
He was, you know, it's not easy to actually describe him. You can't put two or three words on him. He was a complicated character in the sense that he seemed to be all over the place. That's about the best way to describe it. He definitely was a visionary. He definitely was well up to date on the latest thinking on all to do with agriculture and how to advance the fisheries. And he was very politically aware. He was involved in politics. He ran for the seat in Galway several times. Didn't always stay right through to the end. Wasn't consistent in his political career, which made me think that he wasn't terribly convincing. You know, I don't think he would have got the backing because they didn't feel that he would stay in the race to the very end. There was that side of him. The other side of him was that he seemed to be a very emotional kind of fellow, I would think. I mean, he seemed to be ruled by his heart rather than his head. He made some peculiar decisions in life that really wrecked his own political career and wrecked his own chances with Dublin Castle to advance himself in any way. And quite often they were to improve, are because his sympathies lay with the ordinary person. So he made some very silly, you know, if you were his mother, you would say, you know, you foolish boy. But in other ways, it endeared him to the local people. He always made good decisions for the local people. They weren't always the ones that would win him favour in the authorities. but you could admire him greatly for it, but you felt that if he was your husband or your son, he was like quicksilver, he'd run through your fingers. You couldn't trust him to do the right thing.
Kathleen, by the end of his life, do you think that he was content with what he had developed in Clifton?
I think he would have been very satisfied. He used to say very early on in the 1830s that the town had developed far better than he had ever expected it to. And so I think by the time he died in 1839, he would have been very pleased with how it had progressed. I definitely think he would have been.
It's just interesting, and of course, just thinking back of your previous book on Nemo, the engineer responsible for the roads and the piers. He came to Connemara around that period, around the 1820s, wasn't it?
Yes, and he certainly played a big part in the development of the town. Not necessarily him personally, but his presence and the government money that he brought into the area in the work that he had to do. He came in 1822 to construct the roads and piers, and he brought in employment and large-scale public works. But I think most of all, from the point of view of Clifton, he brought with him a skilled workforce. And many of them took up residence here for a short period of time. And I feel, and it's quite obvious from some of the houses that were built at that time, you can see a rapid development in the amount of houses that went up here in 1824 to 1826. And it's simply because Nemo's men have come in and they can construct a house, a better standard, better quality, better designed house that would suit the terrain much more so than Darcy would ever have been capable. I mean, I imagine from the way he writes that he was aware of better quality housing. He was aware of what was happening in Dublin with the Wide Streets Commission, but he wouldn't have been capable of finding that kind of skilled workmanship that would be required to construct the houses and develop the plan that is now so visible in the town today. And you can see from that point on, from 1822 to 1826, the houses grew up, the streets were laid out, and the whole plan of Clifton changed under their guidance and direction.
Do you know if they were friends, Darcy and Nemo?
I don't think they were. I definitely don't think they were. Nemo was a very good friend with the Martins, and the Martins and the Darcys were at war over politics. And it's very obvious in the book, I discuss this in detail about how they ran up, and Thomas Martin just literally in a public speech destroyed Darcy. Absolutely destroyed him, the things he said. Politics was politics no matter what generation you're in, and it gave you liberty to say what you like about your opponent. So I would think that was part of it, and also I just felt from when I was writing about Nemo, I felt that Nemo was in favour of John Darcy in the beginning, and he approved of his work and all of that. He never criticised him, but Darcy certainly criticised Nemo towards the end because he felt the works weren't progressing as fast as he would have liked them, and he criticised him in letters to Dublin Castle. But then so did an awful lot of other people at that period.
I suppose, kind of in conclusion, Kathleen, what would Connemara be like, do you think, if there hadn't been a John Darcy?
If there hadn't been a John Darcy, I think the Martins would probably have got off their backsides and built a town. But they owned all that land and got all that praise and got all that. They had a far greater opportunity to build towns than John Darcy had. They owned, you know, about something like under 200,000 acres. John Darcy only owned under 20,000 acres. They had Roundstone Harbour, which was beautiful, which they never developed until Nemo came around and decided to develop it. Nemo certainly thought that Roundstone would be a bigger town in the long run than Clifton, but it never took off because of John Darcy's perseverance and endurance, I think, and push made Clifton continue to develop, whilst Roundstone never developed into the town that Nemo would have expected. Also, the Martins owned Cleggan, which was another possibility. And there was only one spot in the Darcy estate that was suitable for a town, and that was Clifton. And even that wasn't great, because the harbour was so far inland that it meant that it didn't have the potential that Cleggan or Roundstone would have had. But it was simply down to one man, John Darcy, that the town developed.
Kathleen, thank you very much. And the book is apart from being, it's full of interesting details. And I suppose there's lots of colour in it as well about marriages and people who were getting married and they were falling out with each other. And I mean, it is just fascinating as an account of people as well as the town. And it's really a beautiful production. And congratulations to you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mary.
It's a great honour for me to have been asked by Kathleen to launch her book, A Colony of Strangers. My name is Adrian Led, And John Darcy is my great-great-great-grandfather through my mother's side. When I first came to Ireland in 1968, and then latterly in 1996, I was always worried because I'd read terrible stories about landlords in Ireland who had treated their tenants appallingly. And I always wondered, were the Darcys like that? Well, they weren't, I'm very glad to say. Since I was a little boy, Clifton and its castle has played a great part in our family story. And as a boy, I used to go to my great aunt's house to have tea, which of course was always served at 4 o'clock. And we would sit in front of the fire. And above the fireplace were two old photographs. And one was of a naval officer and the other of a splendidly good-looking woman. I asked my aunt and grandmother about them and learned that they were Captain George Henry Clark, Royal Navy, and his wife Elizabeth. And she was the daughter of John Darcy of Clifton Castle and Kiltulla, and her mother was Louisa Bagot Darcy, and her maiden name was Sneed. And the Sneed family came from Staffordshire. It's a very large old family in Staffordshire. It's now the University of Staffordshire. Although my great-aunt nor my grandmother had ever been to Ireland, they had this mystical love for the place and its part in our family history. However, we know that their aunts, Elizabeth and Louisa, had been to Clifton over several years. We know that in 1812, that they had been over to help look after the children at the Glen Owen Orphanage, which is now, of course, the Abbey Glen Castle Hotel. And I have a letter, I think Kathleen has it, written by one of them back to her brother, John Godolphin Conyers Clark. A chatty letter about how much the price of butter was, and Mrs. Joyce is very good because she gave so much for the money. And then there were the stories from Clifton that were told to me. One of them was that when my great-great-grandmother, Elizabeth Malone Darcy, that's John Darcy's daughter, was dying in 1909, somebody had written to Elizabeth and Louisa Clark, her daughters, and asked if any member of the Darcy family was ill, because the banshee had been heard around the castle. And another was that a member of the Darcy family had ridden through a deep puddle and covered an old woman in water, after which she cursed the family and said it would die out in the male line after so many generations. And I'm not sure that is not what has happened. I don't absolutely know, but I think it may be what's happened. I don't know whether you believe such stories, but as Shakespeare said, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Another little story that is true was that when George Henry Clark invited his future wife aboard his ship, anchored just off the castle, and that a piece of rope that was part of the ladder that Elizabeth had used to climb aboard the ship, he had saved. And when she died in 1909 in Teddington, it was buried with her. They were a very happy couple, by all accounts. My grandmother knew them. And they were very happy, and I have a little miniature. It is reproduced in the book, but on the back of it, I took it out, and it says, "Painted on this, our happy wedding day." And I think that rather sums up their life together. George Henry Clark was a naval officer in the Royal Navy, and his ship was HMS Stromboli, and it was stationed in these waters from 1843 until November 1848. The man obviously loved this place, and it seems that he did not miss an opportunity to return. My wife Shirley and I have returned year after year, and also our sons and their wives, to this magical place which we love so much. We have received nothing but kindness and warmth and welcome from the people of Clifton, and we consider it now our second home. When John Darcy inherited his estate in 1804, he had the courage and the passion to put his whole life into this wild place and its people, and was determined to create something that would last and stand the test of time. Now, he could, when he inherited the estate, living at Kiltulla, East Galway, he could have just taken the rents. And he needn't have taken out a huge mortgage on the place and put himself in penury. That would have been the easy thing to do, but he didn't. Well, ladies and gentlemen, he did achieve something. That's why we are here today, to welcome this new book, in which he would have been so pleased and delighted. And I'm sure he is pleased and delighted. I've been reading my friend Kathleen's book, A Colony of Strangers, these last weeks. And it is a book that is easy to read right from the start. It is a book that one can refer to in the future. It's about the good times and the bad times in this town, and it's had many of those. And it will continue to do so. I never cease to be amazed at the detail in Kathleen's books. Everyone she has written has been painstakingly researched. I know how much she puts into them, and I know how much it takes out of her. If Kathleen never writes another book, the legacy of her writing for Connemara, Clifton, and Ireland is enormous. In this book, she has uncovered facts about John Darcy that have been hidden for years. For instance, I did not know that he was so active in the politics, or that he had a yacht, or that he was such a compassionate man, letting people out of prison when he shouldn't have done. I've learned so much more about my ancestor. I am proud to be his descendant. He was a good man, I think, and cared for his people. Kathleen, I say to you, well done. Clifton should be very proud of her daughter. I therefore want to launch this book, wish it well on its way, and may it be read by all the people who love and cherish this, your beloved town of Clifton. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.